That's Manteca, performed live on March 13, 1955, in Washington, D.C. It is one of the bedrock tunes of Afro-Cuban jazz, composed by Dizzy Gillespie. Chano Pozo, a Cuban conguero and percussionist he hired at the recommendation of Afro-Cuban band leader and arranger Mario Bauza in 1947, as well as Gil Fuller. All three came up with this wonderful number, which is an established jazz standard to this day. It's from Gillespie's all-live album, One Night in Washington. It wasn't released until 1983. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we take a look at a few issues and developments dominating the headlines, especially in international affairs. And when we say international affairs, of course, we're talking about Dr. Gerald Horn, who has been so kind and generous to us to share his unique insights into these areas and more here on Lead Stories. Dr. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 30 books, and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. And he's always working on yet another book. Thank you, Gerald, for being with us today. And what's your next book?
Well, it'll be out in a few days, and thanks for asking. Confronting Black Jacobins, United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, as the title suggests. It tries to extend and expand upon the book written by your countryman, C.L.R. James, circa 1937, 1938. I'm speaking of Black Jacobins, about the Haitian Revolution. And, of course, hopefully it will shed light on the present-day crisis on the island of Hispaniola, now shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic, with the DR government seeking to expel nationals, actually of the DR, who they say are Haitian. And, of course, that particular crisis has deep historical roots, which my book seeks to explore.
Well, of course, I can't wait to discuss it in great depth with you. It's an education in itself, I'm sure. So I look forward to it. Well, today's a big day. Pope Francis arrives this afternoon in the United States, as does another world leader, Xi Jinping, the president of China. Pope Francis just concluded a three-day visit to Cuba. It was historic by all reports and greatly significant, although we may not understand why. So let's take one at a time. Let's discuss Pope Francis and his visit to Cuba. How do you interpret that visit?
Well, first of all, Pope Francis, who, as you know, is of Argentine descent, and of course is well aware of the legend involving his countryman Che Guevara, who of course was of Argentine descent and played a pivotal role in the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, January 1st, 1959. Pope Francis has played a pivotal role in terms of the entente between Washington and Havana that has erupted in recent months, which was just capped off by the Obama administration seeking to relax further the blockade, the so-called embargo of Cuba. Presumably, it'll be easier for U.S. nationals to travel to the island as a result. Pope Francis has stirred a bit of concern in right-wing circles in the United States because of his critique of capitalism, his endorsement of the science behind climate change, the fact that with regard to LGBT rights, he has taken what many consider to be the insouciant stance of saying, who am I to judge? And, of course, he has also tried to move in a much more progressive direction than his immediate predecessor, Pope Benedict. And what's striking, of course, is that those of us who are familiar with the long centuries of Vatican intrigue perked up our ears and perked up our eyes, in fact, when we saw the article in the Washington Post just a few days ago that talked about consternation amongst certain cardinals and bishops, particularly in the United States, given some of the so-called left-wing stances that Pope Francis, who, by the way, is 78 years old, has taken. I need not remind this audience, I'm sure, about the travails and plight of Pope John Paul I in 1978, his short-lived tenure in the Vatican, and of course, rumors still persist that he was poisoned. His unfortunate and untimely demise created the platform and the stage for the emergence of the so-called Polish Pope, whose tenure was much longer, and who, of course, endorsed anti-communist movements in Eastern Europe, attacked the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. His message, basically, was to the priests in Nicaragua, who were allied with the Sandinistas, was get out of politics, and the priests in Poland, who were allied with the anti-communist solidarity movement, he said, get into politics. So that's what the right wing in the United States is looking for. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens when Pope Francis addresses Congress, particularly given the importance of the Catholic constituency to the Republican right. I'm speaking of Speaker Boehner, for example, Jeb Bush, a convert to Catholicism, by the way, Rick Santorum, another GOP presidential aspirant. We all know that with regard to presidential politics, the so-called Reagan Democrats, that is to say working-class Euro-Americans, many of whom are Catholic, who have turned to the right, have been very important to the GOP constituency. And therefore, any progressive words from the lips of Pope Francis will not necessarily be greeted with stormy applause by that particular constituency. I'm sure I need not also remind this audience of the long and tragic history of anti-Catholicism in the United States, the fact that the United States supposedly was born in a rebellion against the religious divisions of Europe, Protestant London versus Catholic Paris and Catholic Madrid, and supposedly the First Amendment to the United States Constitution guaranteeing freedom of faith turned the tables on those religious conflicts. But we know that that has been a work in progress, that convents were oftentimes attacked in the United States in the 19th century. We know that the second iteration of the notorious Ku Klux Klan about 100 years ago during the era of World War I was pockmarked by a virulent anti-Catholicism and an anti-Semitism too, by the way. And so it's been a long and treacherous journey for Catholics in the United States that will reach a certain crescendo with the arrival on these shores of Pope Francis.
Well, in arriving on these shores, first of all, what do you think he accomplished in Cuba?
Well, according to U.S. press reports, he did not interfere in the internal affairs of Cuba. According to U.S. press reports, and contrary to some of the hopes and wishes of the U.S. right, he did not overtly raised the question of so-called dissidents in Cuba. What he said behind closed doors is a separate question. Contrary to what some may think in the United States, even though Cuba was a former colony of Catholic Spain, whose, of course, monarch was known as His Catholic Majesty, the fact of the matter is that the Catholic faith has been on decline. In Cuba, even before the revolution of 1959, we all know, of course, about the persistence of indigenous African religions, Santeria, for example, amongst the population of Cuba. And the Catholic faith in Latin America generally has faced very severe challenges. That is to say, evangelical Protestant Christianity has been eroding Catholicism throughout Latin America, not least in Brazil, El Salvador, Guatemala. And the Holy Father has been trying to shore up Catholicism in the face of that stiff challenge. And on a tactical, if not a strategic level, it would be difficult for the Vatican to, on the one hand, try to shore up Catholicism against the challenge from the Protestant evangelicals, and on the other hand, lead an offensive against the socialists in Havana. That's fighting a two-front war, which is usually advised ill-advised in terms of military science. I should also say that in the United States of America, that it's going to be very interesting to see how the Pope relates to this bifurcation in Catholicism. That is to say that there is a declining Euro-American, that is to say Irish-American, Italian-American, etc., Catholicism in the U.S. Northeast in particular, such as in New York City, where I think you're speaking from. Whereas if you look at the West and the Southwest in particular, with the rising Latino population, migrants from Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, you have a population of Catholics that in many ways is rising, while the population in the Northeast is declining. Fortunately, the population that's rising tends to be more progressive, and it'll be very interesting to see what the Holy Father has to say about the anti-immigration movement that has reared its ugly head in the form of GOP presidential aspirant Donald Trump. And it'll be interesting to see what he has to say about some of the other issues that concern the Southwestern and Western Catholic population.
Well, the curious thing, of course, is that the coverage has centered on Pope Francis as the head of the Catholic Church and not so much as the head of a sovereign state, which is what Vatican City is. So when he met with Raul Castro and Fidel Castro, and when he's going to meet with President Obama, he dances on both sides of the fence, it seems. He's able to take a lot of the political issues and cast them in this arena of religion. And, you know, of course, it gives him an interesting advantage. But it should not be lost on the fact, it should not be lost on us, the fact that Pope Francis played a strategic role in brokering the end of this blockade of Cuba with between Castro, Raul Castro, and Obama.
Well, yes, and to that extent, he's merely reflecting Latin American sentiment. As a matter of fact, according to the Miami Herald, there is a strong possibility that even the United States, when the question of the Cuban embargo arises in the United Nations General Assembly this month, that even the United States might abstain on the validity of this criminal blockade. And we all know that the Latin American states, led by Brazil, will vote as one against that blockade. Pope Francis is in tune with the progressive Latin American sentiment that is rising to a greater or lesser extent throughout the region. And to that extent, it's not surprising that he would first travel to Cuba before coming to the United States, that he would seek to build bridges between Havana and Washington. And once again, I must reiterate that these sorts of policies, which are roundly and widely endorsed in Latin America, and in the progressive community generally worldwide, are not necessarily popular in the North Atlantic countries led by the United States, particularly amongst the white right, which thus far is hegemonic.
Well, another common thread here between the Pope and the President is, of course, the Pope has made it clear that he does not intend to be Pope much longer. He wants to leave that and move on to something else in quiet contemplation. And President Obama seems to be trying to do all that he can in the few months that remain of his term to accomplish something that would speak well of his speak well to his legacy. Do you see a common thread there?
Oh, sure. Of course, President Obama is a few decades younger than the Pope, and therefore presumably has a longer life expectancy. And I also see a common thread in terms of the formidable forces of opposition on the right in Washington as well as in the Vatican. And I think that's one of the reasons why President Obama is going to meet Pope Francis at the airport. He's going to try to bask in the glow of his presence. It's quite extraordinary for President Obama to go to the airport to meet a visiting dignitary. But I think what that bespeaks is that President Obama is trying to capitalize upon the fact that presumably Catholics are duty-bound to listen to the Holy Father. Although, of course, we all know that Jeb Bush says that he takes religious instruction from Pope Francis, but not necessarily instruction with regard to a critique of capitalism or an endorsement of the science of climate change. President Obama, of course, has a very steep road to hoe, not least because I think, as I've said on this program many times before, I think there's an underestimation generally in the United States of the strength of the right wing, not least amongst the Euro-American working class and middle class. I think that there's a certain kind of denial about that. And it's that kind of denial that in the worst case scenario can have us sharing space in an internment camp in Yankee Stadium if we're not careful.
President Xi Jinping arrives today, but in Seattle, and his visit is very much business-oriented. How are you reading President Xi's arrival in the United States, and what is it likely to produce?
Well, first of all, strategically, there is a split in the U.S. ruling elite about China. On the one hand, he's stopping in Seattle. He'll be meeting with leaders of tech giants such as Microsoft and Apple and all of the rest. And they'll be bending their knees and kissing his ring in hopes of getting more business in China and joining the gold rush. But if you read the New York Times, an English language publication, which I presume does not feel that it has much room for market share in China, you will see a very strong attack upon China and President Xi Jinping in particular. And, of course, this is typical of the U.S. press. From their point of view, China is a mass human rights violator, that they would like to see the erosion of influence of the Communist Party, if not its ouster from power. They would like to see the United States resume its military base in the Philippines. They would like to see more visits like that of the leaders of Vietnam to the Oval Office just a few months ago, which was widely perceived and seen as part of an encirclement policy of China. You may recall that President Obama traveled to Northern Australia some months ago, establishing a U.S. military base there. We have all read with concern the stories about the debates in the parliament in Japan about the remilitarization of Japan, and this is taking place in the context of rising tensions between Japan and China, as evidenced by what happened in a remarkable display of Chinese military might just a few days ago, marking the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. This took place in Beijing, in Tiananmen Square. I might say that one of the weapons on display at this remarkable display of military might by China was what was called the carrier killer. China apparently has developed a weapon that can potentially neutralize the U.S. aircraft carriers that routinely sail off the coast of China. We'll have to watch and see what will be the strategic implications of that military development. You may also recall that just a few weeks ago, when President Obama chose to visit Alaska to highlight his concern about climate change, you have the Chinese Navy remarkably sailing into Alaskan waters, presumably making sure that President Obama was warmly greeted in the warm waters off Alaska. It was quite stunning. It should have gotten more publicity. But what I'm trying to suggest to you is that this is a very important visit. It may be an inflection point in terms of the strained relation between Beijing and Washington. It's not clear to me that the economic interests of Microsoft and Apple will carry the day against those elements in the U.S. ruling class who would like to see an escalation of tensions with China. It seems to me that the latter will carry the day, but I'm not sure how important that will be in the long run in terms of trying to arrest the tides of history. The tides of history obviously are running in China's favor. As we've said on this program more than once, the Financial Times of London in 2014 said that by certain measures that the Chinese economy had surpassed the size of the U.S. economy. The first time since 1872, the United States has not had the largest economy on this small planet. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have spoken similarly in 2014. This is an ironic conclusion to the Cold War, because we know that the turning point in the Cold War came some 40-odd years ago when President Richard M. Nixon traveled to Beijing and enlisted the Chinese Communist Party leadership in this anti-Soviet foray. This opened the door for massive foreign direct investment from U.S. corporations into China, which has created this present-day juggernaut. The Nixon visit to China, routinely saluted as a brilliant diplomatic stroke in the cold light of history, may be seen as a blunder of monumental levels. You may also recall that it was in 1979 that paramount leader Deng Xiaoping of China came to the United States. That was in the wake of tightening relations with the Carter administration. And, of course, more contracts were signed between U.S. corporations and China. And that actually marks the takeoff of the Chinese economy, that trip by Deng Xiaoping in 1979, where you might recall he came to Houston, Texas, and donned a Texas Stetson hat as he visited a Texas rodeo. And, of course, returned to China and promptly launched a military attack against Vietnam. And, of course, China had to retreat with its tail between its legs after Vietnam bloodied China's nose. But in any case, that tightened the relationship, which now has obviously reached a fork in the road with the visit of President Xi Jinping to Seattle and then Washington, D.C.
Well, President Xi and China generally doesn't seem to be paying too much mind to criticisms of its human rights records, its unenthusiastic embrace of the need for environmental measures and reforms to reduce global warming and other things, the issue of an unbalanced trade system, the issue even of the so-called manipulation of currency internationally. It seems as if Xi means business, and it's all about business, going to Seattle, addressing the main U.S. and Chinese CEOs. It is probably going to be the case that we might hear something in the order of a major trade agreement being signed between Obama and President Xi.
That's possible, but keep in mind that the so-called TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is basically NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement on steroids, pointedly excludes China and in many ways is devised as a way to counter China. That is to say, the United States and Japan, to a degree with Australia, are seeking to circle the wagons because they feel they have to merge in order for them not to become non-entities in what may become a Chinese century, speaking of the 21st century. Keep in mind as well that there's an equivalent of the TPP that is now being negotiated with the European Union. But also keep in mind that even if there is this de facto merger between the 500 million strong European Union and the 330 million strong United States of America, that 830 million still is about 500 million less than the Chinese population, which gives you an idea of the uphill climb, the steep uphill climb faced by the opponents of China as they seek to reverse the tides of history. Speaking of which, you mentioned the concerns in Washington about human rights violations. What I find striking about the visit of Xi Jinping is this, that simultaneously we could have a long conversation about concerns about police killings of black people in the United States of America, mass incarceration, the promiscuous use of the death penalty. And yet, despite this mass concern as reflected in Black Lives Matter, I don't see any noticeable outreach by those concerned to our potential allies in the international community. I was speaking to a reporter from reporting from the United Nations yesterday about the United Nations supposedly moving to mark a decade of the African. I believe it will be from 2015 to 2025. And I was talking to this reporter about how, if that decade of the African is to be meaningful, obviously we have to have a discussion about reparations and the cruel exploitation of people of African descent by the North Atlantic countries, not only today but over recent centuries. But what's remarkable is that you would think that China, which plays a major role in the United Nations Security Council, would be quite keen to listen to the concerns of those in the Black community in North America, if not worldwide, about the exploitation of Black people, particularly in the United States of America, in order to counter these allegations about human rights violations in China. And so I think historians of the future, assuming that nuclear war, global climate change does not overcome us all, will be quite struck by the missed opportunities, or, dare I say, rank cowardice of some of our even purportedly militant leaders who refuse to connect the dots, which raises concerns and questions about how concerned they actually are about the depredations that are routinely being committed against our communities in North America, since they're not pushing the levers that are available. Now, with regard to business deals, we all know that there was mass panic on Wall Street just a few weeks ago when it seemed as if a downturn in the Shanghai stock market was reverberating across the Pacific, and that was an indication of something we've already made reference to, which is that in days of yore, in days of old, when the United States economy sneezed, the whole world economy, particularly the capitalist economy, got pneumonia. But now it seems the tables have turned. When there's a sneezing in Shanghai, it seems as if there was a cold coming on Wall Street. This is a reflection of the dilemma of the U.S. ruling elite in the wake of President Xi Jinping's visit. That is to say that there's been such an integration of the Chinese and the U.S. economies that it's very difficult for the United States to escalate tension against China for strategic goals. It reminds me of what then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her brief tenure in Washington. That is to say that how do you confront your banker, with China being the banker, because we all know that capital from China, that is to say the People's Bank of Beijing buying U.S. Treasury bills, which then are used to prop up the U.S. government, everything from the Pentagon to aid to education. Given that remarkable relationship, this makes the present-day relationship between Beijing and Washington totally unlike and dissimilar to the previous confrontation between Moscow and Washington. And speaking of Moscow and Washington, part of the problem that the United States faces are the ever closer relations between Moscow and Beijing, as represented in their trade relations, not only in terms of agricultural products, which, by the way, is helping to bail out the Russian economy in the face of sanctions in the aftermath of the Russian takeover of the Crimea from Ukraine, but also in terms of energy and natural gas, in terms of Russia selling weapons to China, in terms of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the eastern equivalent of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization led by Washington, in terms of Russian bomber planes supposedly and reputedly sailing through the air of the zones off the Gulf of Mexico and U.S. Waters. In fact, you can't begin to understand this entente between Havana and Washington, which has erupted in the last 7 months, that is to say, the last 9 months, since December 2014, without understanding Washington's concern that China could be, that Cuba could be some sort of launching pad, like it was during the bad old days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, that is to say the last militant confrontation between Moscow and Washington, that this could reoccur in Spain, with this time Moscow and Beijing ganging up with Cuba to confront Washington, and Obama tries to forestall that by easing tensions with Cuba. This is all part of the backdrop of President Xi Jinping's visit to Seattle and to Washington, D.C.
Well, President Xi is going to be addressing the United Nations, and very symbolically, I mean, these symbolism is such a big thing in the world of diplomacy. He is going to be chairing a meeting of global leaders on the matter of gender equality and women's empowerment. I was reading a story in which Wang Yi, who is the Chinese foreign minister, is quoted. He was asked, well, what is the symbolism or what is the significance of this speech? And he explained it this way. He says, quote, "What China stands for is peaceful development, not hegemony. Greater democracy in international relations, not power politics. Win-win cooperation, not zero-sum game. And a right to approach interests and principles, not a pursuit for selfish interests." Now, that's in diplomatic language, that's a full-scale attack on the United States foreign policy, isn't it?
It certainly is, albeit deftly and obliquely done. Speaking of the chairing of this session, I'm sure that when President Xi Jinping chairs the session on women's empowerment, that former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton will be asked to comment, because you may recall that before she was elected to the U.S. Senate from the state of New York, one of her initial forays into international politics was her going to Beijing during the administration of her spouse, Bill Clinton, to speak at a forum on women's rights that had been convened by the United Nations. And, of course, she was more than subtly critical of China's role with regard to women's empowerment. So it'll be interesting to see what Hillary Rodham Clinton has to say about this. I should also mention another concerning factor. That is to say that we recall that during the first few decades of the 20th century, when the United States was confronted by a challenge from another Asian power, speaking of Japan, that the United States did not respond very well. Recall that in 1906 in San Francisco, that the officials there sought to segregate Asian American students, particularly Japanese American students, in the classroom, K-12 education. This did not go down very well in Tokyo, and led to a worsening tension between the two powers. We recall what happened in the early 1920s when nativists, anti-immigrant advocates, the precursors of Donald Trump, passed a law seeking to restrict immigration from Asia and accelerate immigration from Europe. This did not go down very well in Japan. This led, of course, to raucous demonstrations at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo. And then we can never forget what happens on December 7, 1941, when there is the so-called, quote, sneak attack, unquote, by Japanese bomber planes on Pearl Harbor, the Hawaiian territory, which, by the way, had been contested between Japan and Washington. In fact, the Kingdom of Hawaii, which was overthrown by Washington in the 1890s, was much closer to Japan, both geographically and politically, than it was to Washington, and indeed, as I said in my book, The White Pacific, one of the reasons why Washington overthrew the Kingdom of Hawaii is because they thought that that independent country that was Hawaii would be used as a launching pad by Japan for attacks on the U.S. mainland, and that was forestalled when the kingdom was overthrown, and then, of course, was eventually incorporated into the United States of America in 1959 as the 50th and presumably final state of these United States of America. And, of course, 2 years later, the birthplace of the current U.S. president, Barack Obama, unless you believe Donald Trump feels that that's all fallacious and he was actually born in East Africa and somehow was smuggled into the United States. But this is just a backdrop to discuss the fact that there have been some very disturbing developments concerning Chinese Americans. We all recognize, of course, in World War II, that Japanese Americans were unceremoniously interned, particularly on the West Coast from Seattle to San Diego, and interned in internment camps, concentration camps. You saw, I'm sure, the story quite recently of a bogus frame-up against the chairman of the physics department at Temple University, who was detained improperly by the U.S. authorities. He's Chinese-American. A meteorologist in the state of Ohio, Chinese, I can't recall if he's Chinese-American or a Chinese national legally residing here, who was fired from her position. Other disturbing complaints from the city of San Francisco, for example, which has probably the largest percentage of Chinese-Americans in the United States, about graffiti being strewn across Chinatown and other neighborhoods attacking the population of Chinese ancestry. What I'm trying to suggest to you is that as we enter what some describe as the Chinese century, the 21st century, inevitably, it seems to me, there's going to be an escalating attack on Chinese American, given particularly the nativism and the hysteria and the anxiety that's obviously rocking the white right and many Euro-Americans generally. And I dare say that there will be a spillover effect into other communities of color. That is to say that it will not be possible for, say, black Americans to play the opportunist card and join the anti-China bandwagon and hope that they can escape the whirlwind. The way things are stacking up right now, it's going to be a very bumpy road in the United States of America going forward in this century.
Well, speaking of a bumpy road, many refugees fleeing utter chaos in their countries, particularly Iran, in Iraq, Afghanistan, are finding that their way to European Union nations in Central Europe, their ways are being blocked and the borders are being shut down, creating an even greater crisis. How has the European Union, in your view, responded? And could you tell us what you think is the genesis of it that we are not appreciating enough?
Well, the genesis is obvious. I think this is appreciated on the left in the United States, fortunately. That is to say, the United States introduced chaos into Afghanistan, into Iraq, and now into Syria. And that has generated a tidal wave of refugees flooding into Europe. Obviously, the Eastern European nations, particularly Hungary, have not acquitted themselves well with regard to so-called Christian charity and embracing these refugees that were fleeing war-torn zones in West Asia, which makes rather curious, I'm afraid to say, the fact that many of our friends on the left, to turn the tables on them, were cheerleaders. When many of these regimes and their antecedents came to power in the wake of the tumultuous events of 1989, and you would have thought back then that there was this progressive wave overcoming Eastern Europe. But now, for those who haven't been paying attention, we see that this was a significant triumph on the right. I mean, the religious bigotry that's expressed by the government in Budapest under Viktor Orban in particular has been staggering. It's of a piece with the kind of vitriol and nonsense that's now coming from the lips of the erstwhile neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson, who just said that he didn't feel that a Muslim should be allowed to become president of the United States. Quite remarkable, that kind of religious bigotry, but of course it's of a piece with what's happening, particularly in Hungary, and to a degree in Croatia. And what's even more remarkable is that at least one can say that the Berlin regime under Chancellor Merkel recognizes that to some degree, these refugees are manna from heaven for these demographically challenged European regimes, which have birth rates that are leveling off, that have increasingly elderly populations without younger populations to work so that their equivalent of Social Security can be supported. I think that it helps to shed light on why Berlin has been much more forthcoming than Budapest. And then, of course, we all should pay heed to the fact that the left is stronger in Berlin, the fact that the Social Democrats still wield influence in the higher realms of power in Berlin, not to mention the former communists who still have influence in not only East Berlin, but in the eastern part of Germany. But I should also mention the fact that there are African refugees, too, who are coming into Eastern Europe. Part of this has to do with the debacle, the misadventure in Libya in 2011, led by the United States and the NATO powers, who overthrew the Gaddafi regime without much forethought, and then has turned that nation into chaos, allowing an entry path for Africans fleeing Eritrea in particular, where about 5% of the population in recent years has departed because of the rather draconian rule of President Assayas. By the way, a good percentage of that Eritrean population, believe it or not, has been fleeing into Israel, where they have not necessarily been warmly embraced. But in some ways, this crisis also reveals the wackiness of these European regimes that continue to foolishly follow the lead of the United States. Once again, I should distinguish Germany, which did not join in the misadventure in Libya, and also has talked about opening talks with President al-Assad in Damascus, as opposed to Britain and France, which led the overthrow of Gaddafi, and now are with the United States with regard to the attack on Damascus and President al-Assad. And what's even more curious is this hysteria about Russia's role in Syria. I mean, it's like the bad old days of the Cold War. It's like these people have learned nothing. If you listen to the commentary and read the commentary about Russia and Syria, you think we were back in the zero-sum days of the Cold War. There's no acknowledgement of the fact that a significant percentage of the rebels in Syria are Chechen and are from the southern reaches of Russia, and Russia is quite concerned about these Russian rebels getting experience in Syria and coming back and trying to destabilize the Moscow-based regime of President Putin. You would think that Washington, which we are repeatedly told has a bone to pick with the Islamic State, so-called, would be joining Russia and confronting the Islamic State. Instead, at least rhetorically, they're trying to have it both ways. They're trying to, on the one hand, attack the Islamic State from the air, and on the other hand, trying to attack President al-Assad in Damascus. And it's, at the same time, they're destabilizing the Kurdish forces, particularly the Kurdish forces on the Syria-Turkey border, who have been quite effective in confronting ISIS, and yet the U.S. ally that is Turkey, the NATO ally that is Turkey, has been pulverizing the Kurdish population, which in effect is weakening the front against ISIS, which means that the U.S. position in that part of the world is two-faced and also incoherent, because they're at once seeking allegedly to attack ISIS and yet bolstering forces that ISIS are trying to undermine. You can't have it both ways. The United States is being torn, and it's also reflective of a certain kind of incoherence that's also reflected, and I'm sure you saw the report in the Daily Beast that was validated to a degree in the New York Times that suggested that about four dozen national security and intelligence analysts in Washington are complaining that the U.S. administration has been tweaking intelligence to downplay the threat from ISIS. This is the reverse of what happened during the Bush administration, when the intelligence was tweaked to play up the alleged threat from Saddam Hussein. Now the tables have been turned. I'm sure the Republicans will be making quite a bit about this. But what's remarkable is that in some ways it reflects the incoherence of U.S. policy, given the fact that the Saudi ally of Washington and the Turkish ally of Washington are both trying to destabilize President al-Assad in Damascus, both are turning a blind eye to the so-called religious zealots who are trying to destabilize President al-Assad, if not avidly supporting these religious zealots. Washington's trying to have it both ways. It's trying to ride the fence, and instead it's being torn apart in different directions.
But we hear John Kerry, the Secretary of State, again, ratcheting up the sounds of war, saying that Assad must go. That kind of language means that the United States at this point sees a strategic advantage in so far as Syria is being emptied of its population by virtue of refugees just pouring out of the country. This is a great time. I mean, people would think that this is just disaster, but in some quarters of the world, this is great. This is a perfect time because the people are doing the job of basically disemboweling the country themselves, and the United States will now have a clearer hand in doing whatever it needs to do, and which is, of course, to rain terror from the skies. Is this why the Putin administration has revved up also its military presence in Syria?
I think the Putin administration is much more united than the U.S. administration in Washington. They're much more clear-eyed from their point of view about what they see as the challenge presented by religious zealotry. Keep in mind that 15% of Russia's population is Islamic. Keep in mind that it was only in the 19th century that many of these regions in the Caucasus came under effective administration by Washington. In fact, you know, there are historians who have written at length about how the U.S. administration was moving westward in the 19th century, overcoming and overwhelming indigenous populations, and how at the same time you had the administration in Moscow moving southward and eastward doing the same thing. What's striking, of course, is that the U.S. administration liquidated indigenous populations and therefore helped to create a much more tranquil 21st century. The Moscow administration was either much less effective in the liquidation project or was not so inclined, and therefore they have a 21st century problem, which leads to this issue of the Putin administration seeking to shore up the Damascus-based regime. Once again, I think that Washington's policy is short-sighted, but I think the mistake that the left makes is to personalize it. That is to say that it's not Washington's policy that is short-sighted or Washington's policy that's incoherent. It's Barack Obama is short-sighted and Barack Obama is incoherent. I think a better way to look at it is to see that there are factions within the U.S. ruling elite. You can see that clearly with regard to China, as we just discussed. But something similar is taking place with regard to Syria and with regard to West Asian policy in particular. You have these contending factions. You have the ultra-right Zionist faction, which just suffered a stinging defeat with regard to the Iranian nuclear deal. They're baying for blood. They want payback, and they will no doubt receive it in terms of more arming of the administration of Benjamin Netanyahu, which will no doubt lead to further chaos. You have the so-called neoconservative faction, oftentimes indistinguishable from the Israeli lobby, as symbolized by the recent book by Vice President Dick Cheney and his daughter Liz Cheney, which calls President Obama everything except a child of God in very personal and vitriolic terms. But they, too, are baying for blood. They, too, have not learned the lessons for Iraq. They, too, want a more muscular U.S. policy in that part of the world, and they cannot be discounted because they have substantial support amongst the Euro-American working class and middle class, as symbolized by the chauvinist aspirations of presidential aspirant Donald Trump, not to mention Marco Rubio, Carly Fiorina, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Carly Fiorina, you know, et cetera. So the more sane voices, as represented, for example, on Lead Stories, are not necessarily hegemonic
believe it or not, in Washington, D.C. In fact, you can usually characterize it as being a minority voice in terms of the higher councils of Washington, D.C. And therefore, the right-leaning forces oftentimes are directing and driving the policy. But at the same time, you do have certain liberal circles, as reflected oftentimes in the Council on Foreign Relations, headed by Richard Haass, a former administration official in Washington, and of course, a person who says he was against the Bush foreign policy in terms of his invasion of Iraq in 2003. Oftentimes, they take much more realistic views. They're very heavily tied to Wall Street. They, of course, are headquartered on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. But despite their tony and posh credentials and their rather plush bank accounts, it's not as if they're dominant in terms of policy-making councils in Washington, D.C. And therefore, if you stir up those ingredients that I've just laid before you, the recipe that emerges is incoherence in terms of policymaking, which you now see playing itself out in terms of, on the one hand, trying to oppose ISIS from the air in Syria. On the other hand, trying to destabilize the al-Assad regime, which is the most consistent anti-ISIS force in that part of the world.
So this week, how would you say the administration, the Obama administration, on a diplomatic level, what grade would you give them in the way that they seem to be handling things so far this week?
Well, it's difficult. From the point of view of the U.S. ruling elite and their interests, I would say that given the contending factions, that any U.S. president would oftentimes have to fake left and go right. And the U.S. administration and the President Barack Obama is very skilled at that time-tested tactic. And so from that point of view, I would have to say that President Obama is acquitting himself well, particularly with regard to China, which is the problem from hell, because it's very difficult, as Hillary Clinton said, to act tough with your banker. It's very difficult for the U.S. to confront China the way that the New York Times editorial board and the Washington Post editorial board would demand. And inevitably, they'll give the Obama administration a failing grade because it's going to be very difficult for Mr. Obama to turn his back on Apple and Microsoft and Silicon Valley, which have been major donors to his various campaigns. So it's very difficult. And Google, of course, has been kicked out of China, wants to re-enter China, and probably will be trying to kiss the ring of President Xi Jinping. President Obama is quite close to the Google guys, and so he'll have to listen to them more so than to the Washington Post editorial board. So it's very difficult to give the Obama administration a grade. It would depend upon what constituency you would say that he's duty-bound to pay fealty to.
Well, no question about that, because we did talk about the fact that the president and his, this seemed to be Hillary Clinton's main job, just accompanying major business people all over the world as a kind of personal shopper, a personal ambassador with them, to basically indicate that President Obama sanctions business deals with the individuals she accompanied. It was kind of blatant, I thought, and I thought it was also unseemly and extremely undiplomatic when these things happen so openly. But I guess we've reached a point in American politics where these things, they used to happen behind closed doors and nobody feels compelled to observe any degree of, the old order anymore. It's just what it is, and just accept it. They just accept that this is what your government does. This is what government is for. And I won't forget anytime soon that sign behind Hillary Clinton that says Haiti's open for business, and that seems to have been a primary motivator in the policies shaped by the State Department and enacted by the State Department.
Well, one more point as we close, I mentioned how we can expect further attacks on the Chinese American community and the Chinese resident community in the United States of America. It would not be surprising if that kind of pestilence spread northward into Canada, because we know that there's a huge Chinese population in Vancouver, British Columbia, that already is attracting the ill-advised attention of the Euro-Canadian community, because a good deal of this Chinese population is affluent, because many of the Chinese wealthy are establishing second and third homes in Vancouver, B.C. And the same might be said for the Chinese population in Southeast Asia, which plays a major role in the business community in the Philippines and Indonesia and Malaysia, that it would be not surprising if those populations came under attack as other populations seek to cater favor in Washington by attacking that community. You know what happened in the late 1990s in Indonesia, in particular when there were virtual pogroms against the Chinese-Indonesian population. There was an interesting article in the New York Times just this morning about the Prime Minister of Malaysia, who's indigenous Malaysia, although, of course, that population in Malaysia also has a considerable population of Chinese descent, about 20%, which is dominant in the business community. The U.S. Justice Department is now investigating the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and that is causing concern, just like if the authorities in Malaysia investigated Barack Obama, that would cause concern in Washington. It would not surprise me at all if there was retaliation against the Chinese population in Malaysia. We all know that these Chinese resident populations in Southeast Asia played a major role in the rise of China by investing their capital into China. And Beijing sees itself as something of a protector of Chinese populations in that part of the world, just like Russia sees itself as sort of a protector of Russian populations in Eastern Europe. So, once again, buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a very interesting ride in the 21st century.
A very bumpy ride indeed. Thank you so much, Gerald, for being with us today. Always great education talking with you. And I certainly appreciate your insights, because they come from left field, and that's a good thing.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it opened your eyes to some things that are in the news but not being discussed. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Infectious Myth with David Crowe is up next, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and let me know what you're thinking of these programs. Until then, please know it's a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.